Kia ora, and welcome to the New Zealand History Podcast Channel, where you will find talks on Aotearoa New Zealand history, culture, and society. These talks are organised by Manatū Taonga, the Ministry for Culture and Heritage, with the support of the Alexander Turnbull Library. They are recorded live, either via Zoom or in person at Te Puna Mātauranga o Aotearoa, the National Library of New Zealand.
Welcome everyone to the first of our lunchtime public history seminars. For this year, and we're delighted to welcome Dr. Lucy McIntosh, who is a senior research fellow, is former curator of history at Auckland War Memorial Museum, and her book Shifting Grounds: Deep Histories of Tamaki Makaurau Auckland, which was published by Bridget Williams Books at the end of 2021, has been a hugely well received book and very well reviewed, and has been recognised by a number of awards, including a co-winner of the Ernest Scott Prize for History, and also awards from ARANS and the NZSA. So it has had a real impact, this work. And in Shifting Ground, Lucy explores, as the subtitle suggests, the deep histories that unfolded in some key landscapes in Auckland, and connects them with broader historical context of the city, the nation, and beyond. And so today, Lucy will talk to us about how the histories told from particular places, at particular moments in time, open up new stories and perspectives that can change the way we currently think about the past and present in urban spaces. So please join me in welcoming Lucy.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Kei ngā maunga whakahi o te whanganui a Tara. Ngā wahi tapu, ngā whenua, I takahia e ngā mātua tūpuna, tēnei ka mihi. Ki ngā mana whenua o tēnei rohi, he mihi nui. He kōrero tēnei mō Tamaki Makaurau, nō reira he mihi nui au ki ngā mana whenua o tērā rohi hoki. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Well, hello everybody and welcome. It's wonderful to see you all here today, especially in the wake of a really difficult couple of weeks in the North Island with all of these cyclones. So thank you all for being here. Thank you to Neil for the introduction, to Manatū Taonga, the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, and to the National Library of New Zealand for inviting me to talk about my book. It's great to be here in Wellington and to see so many familiar faces of family, friends, and colleagues here today, and many new faces as well. And it's great to be speaking in this building where I did a lot of the research for the book. Ko wai au, who am I? Well, as Neil mentioned, I'm a historian and a curator from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. I'm currently a senior research fellow at Auckland Museum. I was curator of history there for 5 years. And before that, I researched and wrote about material, spatial, and cultural histories of New Zealand, much of it centering around Auckland, as a public historian. And all of that work over the years has fed into and influenced the research for the book, which I'm going to be talking about today. So Shifting Ground centres around histories in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, but it's as much about exploring the histories beneath our feet wherever we are. And that's why I've called this talk Archives in Place, because the approach I've taken is to start with the ground, diving deeply into particular places, peeling back the layers, exploring the nooks and crannies, and following the threads gathered there across time. From there, I work upwards and outwards, asking how the histories of these particular places might change the way we understand some of the bigger stories we tell about our cities, our nation, and the world. So while the stories I tell here today are grounded, so to speak, in Auckland, they're also about what happens when you deeply engage with the places around you, the material, spatial, geographical, and oral archives in place. So the book focuses on three places in Auckland. The first is Pukekaua, also known as Auckland Domain. That's it's very close to the CBD. It's a popular inner city park in Auckland, and it's home today of the Auckland War Memorial Museum, where I work. The second place is Maunga Kiakia, also known as One Tree Hill and Cornwall Park. and that's in the central suburbs of Auckland, New Zealand's largest par or defensive settlement, a working farm since the 1840s, and the place where a large obelisk sits on the summit, a well-known landmark throughout the country. And the third place is the Otuataua Stonefields at Ihu Matau. They're in Māngere, next to the Auckland Airport, and a place that was unknown to most Aucklanders and New Zealanders until 2019, when a large protest took place there against a planned housing development. There are many places that I could have written about, but I chose these ones because they're in different parts of the city, so each has their own constellation of geographies, histories, and identities. And each of them also, I think, opens up a view shaft into lesser-known histories of the city that deepen and at times challenge the way we understand the past and the present in Auckland. Auckland's home to one-third of the country's population, but like most cities in New Zealand, it's received relatively little attention from historians, with a couple of notable exceptions, including Melissa Matutina Williams and Ben Schrader's recent work. But much of the history there remains unexamined and outdated. To this day, for example, there are histories that still repeat old 19th century tropes about the city's past, that Māori were constantly at war in the pre-colonial era, for instance, that Tāmaki, today known as Auckland, had been abandoned by Māori and was empty when Pākehā first arrived in 1840, and that colonial Auckland was a Little Britain or a Neo-Europe. As well as a lack of historical research on Auckland, a lot of the city's physical or tangible history has also disappeared. Its volcanic cones, its rivers, its headlands, its landmarks have been destroyed over the years as the city's continued to spread and intensify. So it can be hard sometimes to make sense of Auckland from its physical environment and from its written histories. Like many Aucklanders, I grew up knowing very little of the history of my city. My parents weren't from Auckland, so they had few connections with the place. And when I studied New Zealand history at school and university, there were no courses on Auckland history or on urban history. And the situation's still much the same today, although I think that's in the process of changing right now with the introduction of the New Zealand History School curriculum this year. So it wasn't until I started working as a public historian for local and central government, for museums, for iwi and hapū, that I began to learn about the deep and layered histories of Auckland. Those histories were often embedded in material or tangible things, in monuments, buildings, landscapes, sites, objects, taonga. Histories not found in the written sources that historians like to rely on, but found instead in layers on the land, in the stories passed down, in a neglected grove of trees, for instance. One of the places that I worked on during that period was the Otuataua Stonefield, when it became a historic reserve back in 1999. The stories that I came across there and in other places across the city were unlike any that I'd learnt about at university or read about in books or seen in museums. These stories were long, complex, and nuanced, and sometimes painful. They were still very present for certain communities and had shaped the wider city, yet they were unknown to most Aucklanders and to most New Zealanders. So the book's lineage really began back there many years ago, and it continued with a PhD thesis that became this book and with my more recent work as curator of history. And along the way, I've been supported and guided by colleagues, iwi and hapū representatives, descendants of those I write about, friends and family who've all made this work so much stronger, and I'm deeply indebted to them all. And I have the team at Bridget Williams Books to thank for putting such care and effort into producing this book. So for those of you who haven't read the book, and I'm sure there'll be a good number of you out there that haven't, it follows a loosely chronological framework from early human arrivals in New Zealand and around the 1300s to the present day. Each chapter focuses in on a material aspects of one of the landscapes at a particular moment in time, and then it follows those stories up to the present day. So there's a chapter on the early Māori stonefield gardens at Ihu Mātau. There's one on a house built in the domain for Potato Te Whero by the early colonial government. There's another on a mission station at Ihu Mātau, one on an olive grove planted at Maunga Kiakia, another on a market garden run by the Archie family in the domain, and one on the building of the obelisk at Maunga Kiakia in the mid-20th century. So I think when you take this type of approach, when you start with the ground and you build your stories from there, it immediately shifts or refocuses Auckland's history in several ways. One of those is that you move away from the short, truncated time spans that historians often work within, of a decade or a century or post-1840, which is a common one. And you start to see some of the deeper histories that underpin and still explain the city today. The second thing is that you don't have to start in the main street, Queen Street, in the case of Auckland. You can look instead at other parts of the city, places with their own histories, cultures, politics, and networks that have in turn influenced things at the centre, but are harder to see or understand when you start right in town. And thirdly, starting with the ground broadens the archives for the historian, from one that relies primarily on written sources to one that draws also on material sources, environmental histories, oral histories, and spatial relationships to examine the past. I'm not an expert in all of these areas, far from it, but they all provide important insights into different ways that the past has been experienced and understood. They make for a more kaleidoscopic view of history, one that has a long lens and takes in numerous perspectives. My job as a historian was to recover some of those layered, textured histories embedded in these places and then weave them into the bigger stories we tell about Auckland, New Zealand, and the world. So let's have a look at some of these places. And we'll start with the Otuataua Stonefields at Ihu Mātau, a place that most people hadn't heard of a few years ago, certainly when I started writing this work in 2013. But it's better known today, and for good reason. It's a place where people have been picking up rocks for more than 600 years and carrying them, turning them in their hands, arranging and rearranging them to make walls, garden structures, houses, pathways, roads, and more recently, airport runways. Histories here reach back to some of the earliest human residents of the place we now call Auckland, forming important but little known histories that still underpin the city. The Otuataua Stonefields were formed by the eruption of two volcanic cones, which produced lava flows that carried huge amounts of rock with them as they spilled out across the land, creating a rough, dry landscape. Over time, fertile, well-drained volcanic soils formed on the lava fields that were perfect for gardening. These eruptions happened all over Auckland. There are around 50 volcanic cones there, giving a very distinctive landscape, although many of them have since been quarried away. Well, Māori histories of Ihu Mātau and the wider area also begin with the formation of the land and waters. And in one of those stories, a powerful ancestor called Mata Aho formed all of Auckland's volcanic features. And his name is recorded in many of those features across the city, including Ihu Mātau, which is Te Ihu or Mata Aho, or the nose of Mata Aho. So place names like Ihu Mātau record some of the earliest histories in this city. And they also reveal notions of collective identity amongst Māori across the Auckland area that existed long before the city expanded to encompass most of its volcanic plateau. The same broad group of people have been living at Ihu Mātau since the earliest days of human arrivals in the Auckland area, making it one of the oldest, if not the oldest, continuously lived in village in the city. These deep histories have been recorded in Māori tribal histories and in the land itself, with archaeologists finding evidence of Māori living and gardening in the area from the 14 or 1500s. And there are many, many layers of occupation and different activities here across hundreds of years. and that includes the gardening activities of the early Māori in Auckland, who planted the tropical crops that their Polynesian forebears brought with them to Aotearoa, kumara, taro, and yam. Those crops grew well in the fertile soils of Tamaki's lava fields, but Māori also used the rocks strewn across the landscape to help create a warm, sheltered environment for those tropical crops in a subtropical climate. Drawing on the knowledge they brought with them from Polynesia, they cleared the loose volcanic rock from the lava fields to create cultivation areas. They piled up the rock onto existing ridges to create windbreaks, boundary walls, and terraces, and they formed complex drainage systems for their gardens. Those rock wall systems across the stone fields served not only as gardening structures, though. They were also named after particular ancestors and events. So they were places of historical memory as well, which in turn helped to define and organize the way the stone fields were lived in and gardened by particular family groups over generations. And the pathways in between that stonework guided people through the landscape, helping them navigate through tapu and noa areas. So as visitors walk through parts of the stone fields today, they unwittingly follow these earlier systems of gardening, occupation, and memory that are hundreds of years old. These stone field gardens once covered much of Auckland, but almost all of the gardens have now been destroyed by urban development. The Otuatawa stone fields are one of the very few areas that are left. As archaeologists have pointed out, these gardens tell the story of long, peaceful periods of settlement in Tamaki that have largely disappeared from the physical landscape and from the written record. So, you know, Auckland history starts to look a bit different when you begin at a place like Ihumātau. Here, there are longer histories reaching back to the earliest inhabitants of Auckland and telling of continuities and fluidities in Auckland's past that are important to know alongside those stories of constant warfare that are often told in our histories. And built onto those very deep histories on the Otuatawa stone fields, there are also more recent histories there that offer different insights into colonial Auckland. Tamaki, as pre-colonial Auckland was known, has often been portrayed as empty when Europeans first settled here in 1840. But when you look at a place like Ihumātau, a very different picture emerges. In the previous couple of decades, during the intertribal musket wars, Māori from across the Tamaki Isthmus had spent periods of time in Waikato under the protection of the leader Potato Te Whero. But throughout that time, they returned to Tamaki to replant gardens and collect resources, and they moved back to their ancestral lands permanently in 1835. So by 1840, when Governor Hobson arrived to establish the government settlement of Auckland, Māori had resumed their seasonal patterns of planting, fishing, harvesting, and filling the storage pits on their lands. Auckland, far from empty or abandoned, was in fact a place full of movement across the land and waters in well-established patterns. These rhythms were in operation when Europeans arrived in the area, and they continued after the colonial town of Auckland was established. In the first few years of European settlement, Māori lost a lot of their land in the Auckland area, but there were still some places where Māori continued to live on their ancestral lands, and Ihumātau was one of those places. In 1848, there were around 200 Māori living at Ihumātau under the leadership of Epiha Putini, who was an influential leader in early Auckland, but's completely disappeared from its histories. Well, it was at Putini's request that a Methodist mission station was built at Ihumātau in the late 1840s on Māori land next to Putini's kāinga or village and beside the gardens of the Otuatawa stone fields. Missionaries such as Laurie tried to encourage Māori to settle in fixed locations and to follow their strict daily routines. But despite this, Māori continued their more fluid patterns of existence. And this, in turn, continued to shape the mission station and its wider networks. The missionaries noted, for example, how Māori in the area continued to move between their tribal lands, following their seasonal patterns of fishing, planting, and harvesting along the lines of the map we saw earlier. Laurie and others often complained that they weren't able to find their Māori congregation, so they had to follow Māori as they moved around their land so they could continue to preach to them. And as the missionaries travelled round the Manukau Harbour, visiting settlements in the waka provided by Māori, they were broadly following the pattern of movements that had been in place there for hundreds of years. As well as missionaries using existing Māori networks, Māori also began to use the missionary networks for their own purposes, often travelling between mission stations throughout Auckland and further afield. And on the lava fields beside the mission station, Māori continued to cultivate their gardens, providing food for the mission station, for their Pākehā neighbours, and for the nearby township of Auckland. They continued to grow kumara on the stone fields, but they also grew European crops such as potato, corn, wheat, and oats, and they kept pigs, cows, horses, and chickens. And the field systems there began to evolve to reflect these changing agricultural practices. So throughout the 1840s and 50s, there were very different relationships being formed at Ihu Mātau than those at the centre of town. It was not so much a site of cultural hegemony or a neo-Europe, as early Auckland's often been portrayed, but more a mixed place, one forged by both existing tribal dynamics and the structures of the British Empire, one where the knowledge channels flowed both ways, from Māori to Pākehā, as well as vice versa. The sudden shift in this community happened not in 1840, when Māori histories of Auckland tend to end and Pākehā ones begin, but later on, in July 1863, when Māori were forcefully evicted from their ancestral lands at Ihu Mātau and other settlements around the Manukau Harbour, just days before the Waikato War officially began. This moment brings the New Zealand Wars and its consequences into the city in a way that hasn't yet been sufficiently acknowledged in histories of Auckland. The raupatu, or confiscations, that took place after the war had devastating and long-lasting consequences for its Māori communities. Well, those consequences have continued to ripple through wider Auckland and New Zealand ever since, and occasionally they bubble up to the surface, as we saw with the 2019 protests at Ihu Mātau. So these are important stories to know if we're to understand and come to terms with this city's past and with its present. I'm going to turn now to the second place in my book, Pukekaua, also known as Auckland Domain. Well, it's a place that many of you will be more familiar with than the stone fields. It's a pleasant, picturesque landscape and one that was largely created in the early 20th century, where much of the land there was drained and cleared and reformed for the 1913-14 industrial exhibition held on the grounds there and for the building of the museum shortly afterwards in 1929. But even here, in this carefully crafted landscape, there are places that tell longer and more complicated stories about Auckland's past. The duck ponds in the Domain are actually freshwater springs, which were once part of a much larger swamp that was an important resource for Māori. That swamp, which was drained in the 1860s to create cricket grounds, recently reappeared again during the Auckland floods. The springs were also an important resource in colonial Auckland. When the capital first moved to Auckland in 1840, the Domain was part of the Governor's grounds, which ran all the way from Old Government House, now on the grounds of the University of Auckland, across Stanley Street, which was a river at the time, and up to the Auckland Domain. Governor Hobson planned to eventually build a new permanent residence right beside springs, something that never eventuated, of course, as the government moved down here to Wellington in 1865. But in preparation for his new house, Hobson began clearing the fern and converting the land in the Domain to pasture for his horses. and he began building a large garden on the bank beside the springs, which was his own kitchen garden, but it was also New Zealand's first botanical garden. The gardens contained exotic flowers, fruit trees, and seedlings, which were all collected from botanical gardens around the world, planted here in the domain, and then redistributed out to settlers around the country. So from the very beginning of European settlement in Auckland, the domain was an important site of collection, experimentation, and dissemination of plants and scientific knowledge. Now, within this rapidly evolving colonial landscape in the domain, there was also a cottage built for Potato Te Whero, the leading Waikato Ariki, who later became the first leader of the Kingitanga, the Maori King movement. The cottage was built in 1845 by the governor of the time, by now Robert Fitzroy, and it was built on a site close to the government gardens and to the governor's planned new residence. The date of its construction is important. It's right at the time that war was breaking out in Russell or Kororareka, at the beginning of what was to become the New Zealand Wars or the Land Wars. So Governor Fitzroy was wanting to secure the support of this powerful leader at a critical time for the country. The house was a strong statement of the mana of Te Whero, of his close ties with the Crown, and of his central role in the future of Auckland. We're not exactly sure where the cottage was in the domain, and there are a number of different theories about where it may have been. But my best guess from the historical records is that it was at the top of the ridge near the springs, looking out over the township of Auckland, one of the prime locations in town at the time. And it's on the site of what is now the Auckland Hospital grounds, and where actually the mental health unit is now located. While he was living at the cottage, Te Whero met with the governor often to discuss the Treaty of Waitangi and other issues, but he also held a number of large hui in the domain with Maori leaders from around the country as he continued to build and shape the tribal alliances and dynamics in the area. And it's said that Te Whero also gave a new meaning to the name Pukekaua while he lived there, a name that literally means sour hill, but which he used to remember those who had died in the intertribal musket wars of the 1820s and 30s, calling it the Hill of Bitter Tears. So Pukekaua is one of the very few places in Auckland where those wars are remembered, and it gives the 20th century museum built on Pukekaua much deeper foundations that reach into the ground and back across time. So here in the centre of colonial Auckland, you had both Crown leaders and Maori leaders coexisting in the same space, crafting very different but intersecting senses of identity and place, and both striving to maintain a fine balance at a critical time for Auckland and for New Zealand. Te Whero's cottage is now gone, and it's been forgotten about by most Aucklanders, but it's always been remembered by Māori. In 1940, on the centennial of the township of Auckland, Te Whero's great-granddaughter, Te Puia Herangi, by now the Kingitanga leader, planted a totara in the domain in memory of his presence there. The memorial still sits quietly across from the museum today, reminding Aucklanders of the deeper histories that reside in this place. Well, in the late 19th century, there's yet another layer of history in the domain. After the government moved to Wellington in 1865, the botanical gardens by the springs became neglected, and they were soon taken over by a Chinese market gardener. And further down the hill, at the bottom of the domain, Chan Archi and his family established their home and market gardens alongside one of the rivers that flowed from the springs. The Archie family lived at the foot of the domain from 1882 to 1920, when they were removed to make way for a rugby league stadium, Carlaw Park. Like the cottage of Te Whero, the Archie gardens were subsequently forgotten about by most Aucklanders until 2007, when Carlaw Park itself was destroyed and archaeologists uncovered traces of the Archie house and gardens underneath. the hundreds of gardening, cooking, and recreational items found on the site opened up a world that's largely been left out of histories of Auckland and erased from the land. Well, what those excavations found were glimpses of a family that had one of the most successful fruit and vegetable businesses in Auckland in the early 20th century. The Archies supplied fresh produce to many of the city's households and restaurants, as well as to the newly developing international cruise ship industry. And they also had extensive commercial networks throughout New Zealand and around the world, including with China and America. It's a family that went on later to open the first supermarket in New Zealand, Food Town. And all the while, at home in the Domain, the Archies were carefully navigating the European settler practices and expectations of the time, while also implementing their own ideas, practices, and networks. Archaeologists found that the positioning of the house alongside the river, for instance, appeared to align with the spatial principles of feng shui rather than the European property boundaries and the neighbouring buildings. They found fantan counters from a traditional Chinese gambling game and Chinese coins, which were used by workers brought over from China by the Archies, who also lived and worked on the gardens. And among the Chinese brownware, ginger jars, and rice bowls, they also found an English Royal Doulton teapot and teacups. And this is one of those teacups here. It's thought that these were used to entertain European guests, but that's a design that actually derived from the 18th century Chinese porcelain designs. So the teacup itself tells its own story of mutual English and Chinese borrowings over hundreds of years. So here in the Domain, underneath the carefully crafted 20th century landscape, there are earlier stories of relationships between people and their natural environment, the springs, rivers, gardens. There are deeper histories of war and commemoration. There are important relationships between Crown and Māori leaders in colonial Auckland. And there are early Chinese histories that had a significant impact on the city. These stories are all right here in the centre of the city, but they're hard to see until you start peeling back the layers of the land and bringing them to the surface. The final place I look at in the book is Maunga Kiakia, also known as One Tree Hill and Cornwall Park. And here I examine some of the narratives crafted by Auckland's most prominent settler, John Logan Campbell, and how those narratives have intersected with the deeper histories in this place. But today I'm just going to briefly talk about one of those stories. And that's the story about the remnants of a large olive grove at Maunga Kiakia, which was planted by Campbell in 1878. It's a grove that's always looked very out of place to me in the pastoral landscape of Cornwall Park. And it's out of place too with histories of this era, which often describe New Zealand in the late 19th century as the Britain of the South, and tend to focus on the mass conversion of the land to grass. But Campbell ran the olive grove as a commercial venture for over 20 years. And I think when you look more closely at the grove, you start to see that some 19th century settlers in Auckland may not have been trying to create a little Britain. They may have been crafting a broader sense of place here. In 1878, Campbell brought over 5,000 seedlings from Australia and planted them on a plateau. And as well as the olive grove, Campbell also planted there a vineyard, which didn't survive, and he also planned to build an Italianate home on the property, as well as a campanile, which is an Italian bell tower, on the summit of Maunga Kiakia, or One Tree Hill, where he'd recently planted a group of pines. So after trying and failing to graft the olive seedlings with more imported stock from Australia, Campbell paid a very skilled Canadian orchard to do the grafting work for him. And once that was done, the seedlings were planted out over the slopes of the terraces where some of them remain today. Now, the ground on which the olive trees were planted had once been part of an extensive and famous Māori gardening area at Maunga Kiakia in the 1700s. And when archaeologists recently did some work on the olive grove, they found that the topsoil there was full of finely fragmented shellfish, which had washed down from the terraces above over time. So the sheltered northwestern slope, with its fertile volcanic soils mixed through with shells from the middens, created a perfect free-draining site for the olive grove. And for most of the period that Campbell was developing the grove, there was also a Chinese-run market garden beneath the trees, which adds yet another layer of complexity to the site. It's been assumed that Campbell had given up on the grove when he leased it as a market garden, but in fact the grove was thriving, and some newspaper reporters observed at the time that it was partly because of the market gardeners who were constantly ploughing and weeding and applying manure to the grove. When it came to carrying out the first pressing of the olives, Campbell sought the help of an Italian vintner called Giovanni Federli, who was in New Zealand trying to set up vineyards and orchards around the country. Federli spent a week overseeing the pressing operations, and at the end of it, he declared it a great success, calling the olive oil equal to the best in Lucca, Italy. The next step for Campbell was to try and break into international markets. He sent samples of his olives and olive oil to Portugal, where they received very favourable reviews, but the olives that he sent to California leaked on the journey over there and were turned down by his agent in San Francisco, who told Campbell he was still trying to get the disagreeable, bitter taste of the olives out of his palate. Well, Campbell continued to experiment with the olives throughout the 1890s, but he was let down by a lack of equipment and technical knowledge. And in the meantime, refrigeration was invented and mutton, beef, and dairy products began to dominate the New Zealand economy. So the commercial olive grove didn't last, then it would be 100 years before another one was planted in New Zealand. But what it shows, I think, is that even on the property of one of the most prominent, successful British settlers in Auckland, there were alternative articulations of empire at work. The grove had no single lineage. It was a mixture of Maori, North American, Italian, Chinese, and British influences. While it's important to acknowledge the dominance of the British Empire in shaping New Zealand, there are also other, more nuanced influences that shape a place but can be hard to find until you look closely. Here, in this forgotten corner of an iconic landscape, we can see the finer, more varied workings of a local community over time, as well as the wider international networks that were generated from this place. Well, a couple of years ago, some award-winning olive grove producers decided to make olive oil from the Maunga Kiakia Grove for the first time in over 100 years, and they said it was one of the finest olive oils they'd ever tasted. I was lucky enough to get one of the bottles, and I can definitely say it was very, very good. So, three places in Auckland, all with very different histories. What do these places tell us about the city? How do they change Auckland's history? Well, to begin with, I think they bring the physical environment into our histories in ways that often get overlooked. Auckland's lava fields, kumara gardens, trees, freshwater springs, rivers and harbours have actively influenced where and how people have lived across the city since they first arrived in around the 1300s. They are core historical factors that explain much about its city's past and its present, as the recent flooding has shown. Secondly, when you explore the layers of history embedded in places, you start to see the longer human connections between the deep past and the present. You can't understand Auckland's history today if you look at it with a short lens, if you start this century, or last, or even the one before that. There are deep Māori histories and networks and knowledge that have profoundly shaped the city over time and continue to do so. These longer histories are important to know if we're to better understand the places we live in and the diversity of human experiences that are woven through them. And thirdly, I think these places all show more complex colonial histories of Auckland. The city becomes a place that is at once indigenous, settler, and international, with Maori tribal networks, missionary circuits, Chinese trading practices, raupatu or confiscation, and Mediterranean connections all present alongside the structures of the British Empire that have preoccupied historians of colonial New Zealand. These places show the unevenness of collective memory, what's been remembered and what's been forgotten over time. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, these places resist a singular authoritative story about Auckland. When you start with the histories at your feet, it opens up Auckland's history. It makes room for the voices and the silences, for the presence and the absence that makes up the city's past. Thank you. Ngā mihi.
Thanks for listening to this New Zealand History podcast from Manatū Taonga. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you're looking for other content about New Zealand history, check out earlier talks in the series. You can find them on your favourite podcast channels. Just search for New Zealand History. Mā te wā!